Welcome to the CSIS podcast. I'm Colm Quinn. It wasn't hard to notice that March was a bloody month. And while the bombings in Brussels earned the most headlines, terrorist attacks in Pakistan, Iraq, Turkey, and the Ivory Coast meant that terrorism's reach was felt around the world. The most recent data available from the Global Terrorism Index notes that attacks by terrorist groups are in fact on the rise. So what can be done about it? This week, we hear from Juan Zarate, former White House counterterrorism official and senior advisor at CSIS, on the factors driving this trend.
Well, Colm, what you're seeing in various places, not just in the arc of instability, which we've discussed and defined as the area from South Asia through the Middle East into West Africa, which has seen the rise of militancy, terrorist groups, instability, and in particular in the wake of the Arab revolutions in spring, greater instability and lack of governance, but also outside of those zones, and in particular recently in Europe. And I think what you've seen is a consistency of the pace of these attacks, some of which can be explained by the endemic and ingrained militancy that's tied to not just instability, but insurgencies and activity that's already at play. So, for example, in Nigeria, in West Africa, the role of Boko Haram, which now flies the flag of ISIS, their continued attacks, the role of ISIS, of course, in Iraq and Syria, but certainly further afield in places like Istanbul and Beirut, and the continued role of the Taliban in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and even Al-Qaeda in West Africa, with the Ivory Coast attack and other hotel attacks, and then, of course, the Charlie Hebdo attack. So what you're seeing is some of these attacks sort of already embedded in existing instability and conflict, but many of these groups continuing to try to expand their reach and taking advantage of the ability to attack in new places with operatives who are clearly committed to the cause and have been radicalized either as part of training or via the internet. And so this is a period of great instability in that you have multiple terrorist groups trying to radicalize, growing more sophisticated in their operations. For example, ISIS has been more aggressive with secure communications. So what you've seen is not only a broad geographic scope of these attacks, but also growing sophistication of these groups to operate in more sophisticated ways, which has allowed them then to infiltrate into the heart of Europe in Brussels and Paris, to do so in ways that keep them out of the eye of counterterrorism and security officials, and have allowed them to perpetrate strategically significant and devastating attacks in the heart of Europe. And so it's a number of factors that have led to what I've called a quickening and adaptation of this movement. And these groups, whether it be ISIS or Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, that have continued to motivate their actors that are competing with each other often for propaganda space as well as operatives, and are continuing to try to hit the West in strategic ways. All of that is motivating the wave of attacks that have defined this past year, and I think will continue to bedevil counterterrorism officials.
Is part of this due to the fact that this works? You know, these terrorist attacks, they spread fear, but they also lead to these propaganda victories that almost feed on themselves.
Absolutely. And I think what these groups have done is not only to realize that they can use these attacks to great effect, but that they can use different kinds of attacks in strategic ways. And so you've seen an evolution, for example, from Al-Qaeda's major attack methodology, thinking that the next attack had to be bigger and grander than the last. 9/11 style attack had to be strategically damaging unto itself, to a more varied set of attacks that the terrorist groups are trying to perpetrate, everything from a sophisticated high scale attack like a 9/11 to a Charlie Hebdo or a Paris or a Brussels style attack, which is very sophisticated, impactful, strategic, and shuts down a major Western capital, to less sophisticated attacks that still are disruptive and cause terror, to the lone wolf terrorist attack, the one-off that continues to terrorize but takes advantage of radicalized individuals who are willing to attack fellow citizens in fairly direct but less impactful ways. What ISIS has done and what Al-Qaeda has done over time is to take advantage of that full spectrum of potential attacks to achieve their goals of terrorizing, their goals of trying to impact Western societies, their attempts to gain control of territory and resources where they're operating, their ability to motivate and attract recruits, and to animate their broader geopolitical or theological or strategic goals. So you're absolutely right that you've seen a wave of these attacks, but different kinds of attacks as well that at the end of the day serve the purposes of these groups to not only gain adherence but also to drive their strategy and ultimately, with respect to the West, impact Western policy and decision-making.
These groups that have been active in the past month, I mean, there's obviously ISIS on one side, and we've talked at length about ISIS in the past, and Al-Qaeda also. There's also, you know, the Pakistani Taliban and their splinter groups. All these groups kind of have their nuances. And is there something that's been learned over the past almost 15 years now in how you counter these groups?
Yes, I think there are some successes in the past 15 years from a counterterrorism perspective that can give us guideposts as to how to deal with these problems and issues. First and foremost, you need to understand the intent and capabilities of these groups. And I think part of the challenge of the last couple of years is that we've lost sight of and been blinded to the nature of the Islamic State, its rapid rise, its willingness and desire to hit the West, how it's tried to infiltrate. And so first and foremost, there has to be a robust commitment to information sharing and collection around what these groups are trying to do and how they're adapting. We've played catch-up with these groups now for the past few years, and you're seeing that counterterrorism officials are having to react to discoveries around how they operate, and I think that's a major challenge. So a major lesson here is we need to be very aggressive around intelligence collection and analysis, and in particular sharing. And I think that's been a major deficit in the European context. And that has to be done in the context of intelligence gathering for the sake of prevention, not just post facto prosecutions or arrests. So that's one key lesson. A second is that it takes the full spectrum of international, federal, state, and local authorities to counter the reach of these groups, both in a preventative way, as these groups try to recruit individuals, radicalize communities, to the point then of mobilization of terrorist operatives. And that ability to leverage all the elements of law enforcement and intelligence to do the preventative work as well as the intervention and the ultimate disruption, that's critical as well, and that takes a lot of effort and a very clear commitment at a national and international level to have that kind of cooperation. Then you have to deal with the reality that this is a movement, whether it's the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or ISIS, that is preying on certain factors in the environment that have allowed their ideology, some would call it their theology, to take root and to motivate actors. And that has to do with the allure of their message and mythology. That has to do with a crisis of identity and a quest for heroism and meaning by certain individuals, in particular Muslim youth. It has to do with lack of governance in particular parts of the world. Has to do with lack of opportunity as well in some cases. And so these broader issues of the growth of these groups, their attractiveness to both young men and women, has to do then with these longer-term issues of how you deal with an ideology, a theology, a group that is trying to, in a variety of forms, attract adherence, ultimately be destructive, and challenge at the end of the day, the governments and governance in their midst, and trying to replace that with a much more violent, much more restrictive form of governance. And so, it's all of that, Colm, that I think we've got to deal with, I think it starts first and foremost with understanding the threat, the network, how it's evolving, all the way to confronting the ideology. And that's in part why at CSIS we launched the CVE Commission, to come up with innovative ways to think about confronting and undermining and ultimately perhaps even replacing that ideology, which is grown in certain pockets around the world.
I want to turn to the attacks in Belgium now. There was a lot of hand-wringing on this side of the pond, on the US side, that the EU could have done better, that Europe could have done better, that there's a lack of cohesiveness there. There has been some amount of dust settling since those attacks. And do we have a clearer picture about what went wrong, what could have been done better?
I think the sense that Europe has to improve, and certainly before the Brussels attacks, should have improved its information sharing as a continent and as a union. That is a fundamental finding, I think, of what's happened. I think there have been a number of data points that suggest that not only was the European Union blind to some of the activities of this particular network, but that there was a broader assumption that the Islamic State had not really committed to a program of effectuating attacks in Europe, despite evidence that the Islamic State was seeding particular actors in the environment. The New York Times wrote a very good piece on this, and I think it was illustrative of the fact that Europe and perhaps even the United States had made the assumption that the Islamic State was not intent or not capable of seeding operatives into Europe with strategic impact and able then to operate. So first and foremost, I think there was a challenge of the underlying assumption as to what the Islamic State was capable of doing or even intent to do. Second is the fact that European countries outside of certain outliers have not been as aggressive in terms of their intelligence gathering and intelligence gathering sharing on a real-time basis for purposes of prevention as opposed to case building. The revelation that the Paris operative who survived and was arrested by Belgian authorities before the Brussels attack, Abdel-Salam, that he was not asked about any ongoing networks or threats moving forward, was simply asked about some past activity, and was only questioned for a short amount of time, suggested a lack of urgency and a lack of appreciation for the value of what that individual could potentially provide in terms of leads to prevent further attacks. And so that's an example of where we now have learned that there's been less than robust information sharing on a real-time basis or information gathering in a way to try to prevent attacks. And we know, of course, that there are legal strictures in the nature of European laws that have limited the ability of authorities to gather information, to engage in disruptive raids, for example, and to do other things collectively as a European Union to deal with this issue. And so ultimately, you know, I judge this not only by whether or not the Europeans have been able to determine the threat and to prevent it, but also based on what the Europeans say they are intending to do. When President Hollande of France says that Europe is at war, you then have to judge whether or not Europe is acting as if it's at war. And this isn't just about military activity abroad and denying ISIS safe haven in places like Iraq, Syria, or Libya, but it's about how they're treating with urgency and determination as a European Union the fact that they have a terrorist threat in their midst, one that they didn't fully appreciate, and one that has clearly been able to manifest in some dangerous ways with the attacks we've witnessed in Paris and Brussels. It is important to keep in mind that ISIS continues to perpetrate attacks around the world, and that you have those that want to subscribe to the ISIS ideology, that want to fly the ISIS flag, in addition to Al-Qaeda affiliates, continuing their attacks and plotting around the world. And so you've had a resurrection of terrorist activity in Southeast Asia, which post 9/11, post Bali, had been in many ways suppressed. You've had a tax increase in Turkey, in Beirut. You've seen continued al-Qaeda attacks on hotels in West Africa. You've seen the Taliban attack viciously this children's park in Lahore. And so these movements will continue to perpetrate these attacks in fairly violent and vicious ways, even if a Brussels or a Paris isn't hit. But I think the broader point here is this is a movement in various manifestations that is intending to have global impact and trying to hit in as many places as possible. Part of this is made possible by the scope of the geographic expanse of where these groups operate and how much territory they control. And as long as groups like ISIS control territory, whether it's in the heart of the Middle East or well beyond, to the extent that al-Qaeda and Taliban have safe haven from which to operate, they are going to be able to plot and plan, and we're going to be facing a global threat that will be challenging to confront and that we will have to constantly adapt to. And I think that's really the danger and the wake-up call here with respect to the Brussels attack, not only that ISIS can perpetrate these attacks in quick succession under the noses of European authorities and to do so in fairly strategic and sophisticated ways, but also that this comes amidst a series of attacks that have happened on a consistent basis on a fairly broad geographic scope in a way that has strategic impact, not only for ISIS, but in the environments in which those attacks are happening.
And that was Juan Zarate. We've reached the end of our show for this week, and we'll, of course, be back with more next week. Thanks for listening.